So the subtlety of practice that I was going to mention tonight and then have it followed by a discussion is something in Zen practice called holding fast and letting go. Many of you have probably heard this term before. I've mentioned it in prior talks. If you read the koan in the Mumonkan, in particular the Hekigan Roku, holding fast and letting go appears over and over again in different koan. And it is, if you get on the wavelength of what these mean, it's very close but two-sided, like a two sides of a coin. So if you wanted to look at what we're doing in practice, we're doing both. Sometimes simultaneously, it'd be like fingers intertwined with both palms together. But oftentimes we will emphasize greatly and go deeply into one side and deeply into the other side in order to explore and not get attached to one particular way. Now, I'll mention first holding fast because that is probably the standard idea, notion, and approach of Zazen, particularly when we're starting out in practice. And holding fast, I would describe as a combination of things. It's an attitude of mind, it's a style of practice, and it's a direction of pointing. So holding fast would be a taut posture, which is actually something we have throughout all of our Zazen, whether we're doing holding fast or letting go practice. We keep our posture taut. So there's a certain style of holding fast, which is taut and intent. And then it shades into intense. And it shades into directed and one-pointed. And the direction is something that is difficult for people who have never done mindfulness practice and beginners in mindfulness practice to kind of grasp or get on the wavelength of. This direction is what you might call in. So just to give you a little analogy, if you've ever read this wonderful book, I read it many, many years ago, called Flatland. It's a book, it's a mathematical, poetic exploration of dimensions, with the underlying point being something very spiritual, but it doesn't come out and say it. And it's a wonderful book. I highly recommend it for any Zen practitioner. But I'll just mention that there's these beings that are locked in certain dimensions. And if we were to, for example, look at the beings locked into two dimensions, they live on a plane, and they have no idea what up and down is. And when they look out, all they see is lines, because they're stuck on the plane. So when they see, you know, one of them might be a triangle, another a circle, they can't really know what they are because they can't see it. They only see lines. So everything looks like a line, and these lines are actually, in a sense, you could think of them as dividing lines. So many of us can lapse into a two-dimensional view of the world, populated by dividing lines, black and white, no subtlety. Now, if one of these creatures is lucky enough to jump out of the plane, they suddenly realize there's a third dimension. And they realize it's up and down. And then they're living in the realm that we live in. But just to push the analogy a little further and not call time the fourth dimension, although it would fit with this, a three-dimensional being like we find it very difficult to contemplate another dimension. So we have our three spatial coordinates, up, down, left, right, front, back, right, however you want to say it. We can easily picture that. We can move in that world. But it's very hard for us to picture a fourth dimension. And one of the reasons why is just like in the land of two dimensions, the third dimension is hidden from view, because you're stuck in a plane. The fourth dimension in our three-dimensional sphere is hidden from view. And we can go there, but generally it needs to be pointed out, and the method of going there needs to be pointed out. And this is not Flatland, but it's just my stretching it probably to the breaking point. The fourth dimension is what we learn to do in our zazen, which is in. So it's something that oftentimes people avoid. It's either fearful or pointless or boring. And many, many of us, and that includes us at various times in our life, are very outward-directed, goal-directed, looking for stimulation, afraid of boredom, not wanting to look inside because there are dark creatures there, and it's pointless anyway, it's a waste of time, and it's introversion and all the rest of it. But in fact, in zazen, we go in that direction intentionally. So this is the direction. The attitude is tautness, and the style is tautness, and the attitude of mind is intent. Almost it can get to a point of being driven, and there are times in our practice where we do this style of practice, and as we get deeper into it, we play with that a little bit. We can really sit very hard and very intently. A symbol for that would be the Manjushri figure holding a sword. So it's like the sword of practice. You might call it storming the gates of heaven. But the direction is in. And we keep going deeper and deeper in this direction and avoid getting trapped or waylaid by maintaining inquiry. Always not knowing where we're going and trying to go underneath any conclusion. Underneath, underneath, underneath. Inside, inside, inside. So this would be this holding fast. Now, how does that go wrong? If you look at what's going on in the world today, particularly in the news yesterday, it's just so incredibly disturbing, and what's happened in the past week or two in Paris, and then again California, is so disturbing, terribly disturbing. So this is a kind of holding fast. This is holding fast gone wrong, holding fast to the extreme. The corollary in our practice would be beating ourselves up, being intensely goal-directed, feeling this something we don't have, and we have to get it, and we don't know if we can get it. And this kind of practice taken to the extreme can be damaging, can hurt you. And probably most very serious Zen sitters at one time or another lapse into this style and may get a little waylaid. That's the importance of working with a teacher, I think, at least in one aspect. So how is this holding fast? Well, if you look at the ISIS, for example, they are driven by an ideology. The ideology is very rigid. Their aim is some Armageddon-like apocalyptic destruction of form in this plane and going to a place of happiness or nirvana or whatever it might be. And now the other thing is the means is justified by the end. It doesn't matter what the means are, it's completely justified. So you can see how this is a very rigid, intense, intent, holding fast that has gotten infected with belief and hatred and anger. Now, this is so infectious. It triggers the same kind of holding fast reaction on the other side. So now we talk about the other side. For example, you look at Donald Trump and his recommendations and many of the very conservative Americans and people, and to some degree they have a valid argument. We have to protect ourselves, we can't be foolhardy, etc., etc. But when this becomes rigid and extreme, and when the end justifies the mean, and when you dig in your heels and things become very black and white, and what you want is a leader who tells you what to do, and you want a belief system that has no shades of gray, then what you begin to notice, if you're just observing with your Zen mind, is that there aren't two sides in that battle. They're both on the same side. They're both holding fast in a very infected, distorted, perverted manner. So in our Zen training, we have to avoid getting, we have to do this intently, but we have to avoid getting infected by intense, goal-directed, feeling of lacking and wanting to find something in the outside to get to make you feel whole, and all these things that can infect our practice. Now, what is letting go? Letting go is actually equally important, although somewhat less emphasized, particularly early on in Zen practice. But letting go has its kind of direction, its style, its attitude. So its attitude would be very expansive, joyful, open-hearted, accepting, embracing. Its style is relaxed, flowing with, see, no tension. And its direction is, I'll put it in quotes, outward, outward. So what is this in her Zen training? I could give you a poetic example. There's a koan where the monk asked the Zen master, what is the indestructible? He said, the world of form eventually rots and gets destroyed. What is the indestructible Dharmakaya? And the master answered with a poem. He said, brimming mountain waters are blue's indigo. Blooming mountain flowers are like a golden brocade. So this is that outward, you see. Now, when the master says this, he's not standing looking at these things. He's in a samadhi state, at one with these things. There's no dividing line. There's actually no one standing outside the experience. So another way that this letting go is described in Zen practices, the person in this letting go state of positive samadhi, rather than the absolute samadhi of holding fast, is deaf, dumb, and blind. Seeing happens, but there's no seer. Hearing happens, but there's no hearer. There's no words that can be put on the experience. It's ineffable, of deaf, dumb, and blind, in a sense like that. That is actually a very short supply in the world right now, as things get very hardened around this holding fast, and the loudest voices, when we have this more expansive view, are appearing to be on the same side of the fence in their style and their direction. So this is holding fast and letting go. What would be an example of holding fast from a koan? Someone asked the master, what is Buddha? And the master answered, mind is Buddha. Okay, that kind of thing. So it's formless, no color, no form, no sound, no smell, no taste, no touch. Unchanging, unborn, undying. Your true nature, your self with a capital S. All these things. In our Zen practice, we learn initially to go very intently in this holding fast direction, holding fast to the count, holding fast to the breath, holding fast to mu or hu or whatever koan. But we eventually are able to bring in aspects of letting go. We should actually do it early on, and I'll tell you one way you can do it. I emphasize very much a taut posture because I feel it helps us to get into this holding fast mind state. But some aspects of the posture need to not be tense. You need to be very aware, for example, that your shoulders are completely relaxed. If you sit in a lotus posture, you're not holding your legs tight. You're not cramming your hands like this. So there's aspects of your posture that are actually quite relaxed, even a little loose, while you keep the back very taut. The eyes are half open. That's a kind of letting go. All right, so you're letting in. Letting go is letting in. It's orienting to the world around you, so all your senses are working. Holding fast is this taut posture. So even in our Zazen, right from the start, we're learning to do both. So I just thought I'd open it up for comments, discussion. I didn't want to dominate too much with a didactic talk. So do folks find this at all helpful? It's kind of a subtlety of practice. I don't think you're going to read it in any book on Zen.
I'd say it's things you have to experience.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. You're right. So it would be one thing for someone to talk about it, but that's only pointing it. You actually have to go in that direction. Are you able to do both in your Zazen? Do you understand this holding fast and letting go?
Somewhat.
Mm-hmm.
Some days.
Anyone else here have a sense of that in their Zazen, holding fast, letting go? I very often will do both in one sitting period. I'll move between the two. Just try to be very flexible. Try to really, really zoom in tight. And then just let myself zoom way out so that any separated entity starts to fuzz out and disappear. So you can do that with shikantaza a little easier than with a koan that requires you to really focus on the koan, or breath practice where you're really focusing on the breath, which is more of a holding fast. But it is possible, and I think advisable, in your Zazen to practice both sides, practice holding fast and practice letting go. And be aware of the dangers of holding fast. They can creep in without your being aware of it. Your practice can become very hard, very uncompromising, and it can be a kind of beating up on yourself. So you have to be careful. You have to be, when you're doing holding fast practice, you're really getting into the intentness of it. You have to be careful about that. Be aware of any kind of self-criticism that creeps in, any sense of lacking, things like that.
Yeah, I was just going to actually make a comment right along those lines, Paul, that place where the holding fast can turn into a way that is not particularly helpful is when you begin to watch it and you're criticizing yourself, when your mind is participating in this holding on. Because as long as it's doing that, then it is holding you back.
Mm-hmm.
And so letting that out, you can still hold on in a way that's now very powerful, but not being interfered with,
mm-hmm.
if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. In other words, when you impose it from the outside, and this is, someone sent me an email, a student is contemplating coming here, and said, I have a lot of apprehension because I'm worried about this being a very strict place because I know what Zen's all about, and I just feel apprehensive about that. And I answered her, no, it's not strict. And one of the reasons I said is that you should not impose this kind of intentness from the outside. So to impose it from the outside is to now make someone force it upon themselves. So it's like your mind is telling you have to sit like that, which is exactly what Susan's talking about. The mind becomes like a taskmaster, pushing you, rather than it organically developing as a jodiki energy and a deep resonation with your heart and a deep faith that pulls you. So rather than pushing yourself towards it, it's like this center has a gravitational field that you get into and it pulls you. There's a different attitude. So I was very clear with this person that this kind of holding fast and intentness, it needs to be organic and come from within, and that we don't impose it from the outside. Any other comments?
Yeah, I had a comment. I think another way that you can work with this right from the beginning is something that I got from Alan Wallace, who's not a Zen teacher, but a teacher that I've worked with quite a bit. And he always talks about balance, that your practice should always be balanced, and that we're balancing between excitation and laxity is what he calls it. But it's something that you can see right from the start, so that if your mind is starting to churn thoughts and getting all worked up and finding it really hard to settle, then you realize, okay, I need to let go because I'm getting overexcited. Whereas if you're starting to fall asleep, you need to intensify. So even when we first start to sit, we tend to be bouncing between those two poles, and it's, you know, a question of seeing where we are and applying the remedy.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes something just as simple as opening your eyes up a little when you're getting into that dreamy state, kind of losing your focus, just opening your eyes and bringing it back a little more taut. But when you go overboard, then the thoughts can start pouring in and the criticisms, and you can just really lose it with intentness and tension. And then I think you need to kind of relax and let go a little bit. But it's absolutely a balance, and it's a very fluid balance. And there's no perfect way to do it. Depends, too, on your mind state that day, on your physiology, circumstances. So we learn over a long period of time to kind of tune our zazen so that it helps us resonate with what's going on in our life and around us and inside us. So that's a very good point. Tell us more about Alan Wallace. I'm curious about him. Is he a Zen teacher?
He's not a Zen teacher. He teaches in the Tibetan tradition.
Oh, okay. Right,
He's actually a student of the Dalai Lama. He's based in California, but he's one of these guys that tours endlessly. You know?
Right.
But he wrote a book called The Attention Revolution, among many, many, many other books that he wrote. But it was a book that my Zen teacher recommended to me at one point, and it just blew me away. You know, it was one of these books.
Really?
Like, wow, I have to work with this guy.
So The Attention Revolution.
The Attention Revolution.
Worth reading. Yeah,
it's really worth reading.
Cool.
I guess what I said sort of sums it up in terms of he just gives a really precise way of working with the mind and getting increasingly concentrated.
Mm.
But very, very gentle.
Mm.
And I think that the reason the book was so important for me is because I came across it at a point in my Zen practice where I was way too wound up, you know? Just what you're talking about.
Exactly.
Just what you're talking about. And I just needed to find a way to...
So holding fast became infected with goal direction, self-criticism. I went through that for years and years. you can get stuck in that space for years. And you can feel in some way that you're making progress because you're definitely developing jori-ki and a certain samadhi power, but it's a stuck place. It's very stuck and it can be very painful. So it often takes a long time to unwind it. Now, you mentioned Alan Wallace and the Tibetan tradition. There's so many resonations between Zen and the Tibetan tradition. They're both part of this Vajrayana school of Buddhism, this very mystical and meditation-based approach. But Tibetan Buddhism is wonderful in that it has very detailed maps of the mind and instructions for progressing through your meditation with all sorts of tools. Zen is a little more steep and stark, and it kind of throws you into your own design, so to speak. It doesn't give you a lot of intimate direction. It lets you find your own way and often struggle for years trying to find your own way. So there's pluses and minuses to both, I think. The minus of Tibetan Buddhism is that a lot of the colorfulness of it and the multitude of practices can become distracting, and it can be attractive to the thinking mind. So I think that, you know, both ways have a lot to add to each other, perhaps. Some people are very drawn to the Tibetan approach from a personality standpoint. I particularly was drawn to Zen, and I don't feel particularly drawn to the Tibetan approach, but I think we can learn from both sides. So, what else? Anybody else have any comments?
I think what you said about it being organic is really important.
Mm-hmm.
I think you do hit a point in your practice where you said about like fine-tuning. Mm. Where you do realize, like for me, there is a point where I'm sitting where I feel the, I don't know what to call it, the impulse to suddenly let go.
Mm.
And it's not, like I said, it's not every day. But I was somebody who also went through, like, say, a phase of practice where it became very rigid.
Mm.
Very rigid. And that, I think, was the solution to
right.
was eventually just one day I was like, no, I can't let this go.
So just for the tape, I'll try to restate what you're saying, is that you feel that it needs this approach to Zen, particularly the holding fast, needs to be organic, and that you yourself personally experienced going through this stuck place of fighting yourself and being overly intense with your practice, and you learned to let go, sometimes abruptly let go, mm-hmm. and really open up the horizons. So I would just say a little bit more about that. In Zen practice and in Buddhism in general, there are experiences called Kensho, awakening. Some of them can be very overwhelming. Some of them can be very subtle. But there's a Kensho along the line of holding fast, and there's a Kensho along the line of letting go. And when we have practiced long enough and gone deep enough into both sides that we can get at least to some extent on the wavelength of this holding fast, letting go, from the standpoint of everything is one big self which has no form, color, sound, smell, taste, touch, spread throughout all of reality, unborn, undying, etc., etc., and see the side where you are dissolved in the world. There's nobody standing aside. Then you can begin to bring these things that you're seeing ever more clearly into your zazen, moment by moment, and even go between the two. So that's another aspect of practice that the koan really help us do. So when we start to go through the koan curriculum, some of the koan will, even after an awakening in the holding fast, you know, deep absolute samadhi side, will keep pushing you there, because that can always be deepened and you can lose it and forget it. And then many of the koan, probably most of the koan, if you were just numerically compare the holding fast and letting go, are about letting go. Jumping off the 100-foot pole.
That's what I was thinking.
Manifesting your body in the 10 directions. So there are both. And I think the koan curriculum is a wonderful and poetic guide for us who resonate with it, to really go deeply into both of these sides and yet maintain a balance, not get too far on one side or the other. So I think it's time for us to say the four vows.